Our next presenter is clearly, for this audience in this town, needs no introduction. Bob Scheer has been a fixture, a major presence in West Coast journalism and nationally for more than four decades. I hadn't quite realized, he mentioned to me that Ramparts, which he founded and edited, actually began in 1964. Bob has been a central contributor to the dynamism of journalism and left journalism for all this time. Of course, people here regularly read his column in the Los Angeles Times, which he had for 12 years, quite a run, and he was dramatically fired in November 2005 as part of the LA Times, the revamp of their opinion editorial page that also saw the firing of their conservative editorial cartoonist, Michael Ramirez. But that has not in any way stopped Bob Scheer from continuing here on the West Coast and nationally. He teaches communications as professor University at USC at the Annenberg School of Communications. He has a nationally syndicated op-ed column for the San Francisco Chronicle. People may hear his him on the radio, on National Public Radio, KCRW, a national program, left, right, and center every Friday. And finally, and perhaps maybe especially relevant for this session, Bob has moved on to found his own online magazine. People know Truthdig, which won the Webby Award for Best Political Blog in 2007. Bob has written a long series of books. I don't have time to list them all here, but people remember, I'm sure, his first one back in 1963 with Maurice Zeitlin right here in the sociology department, Cuba Tragedy in Our Hemisphere. He wrote on Reagan's new nuclear policy with Enough Shovels, Reagan, Bush, and Nuclear War, 1983. And more recently, Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq, which he wrote with his son Christopher, and Lakshmi Chowdhury in 2003. And finally, his new book, next to last, Playing President, his interviews with the presidents, Playing President. And finally, the about to come out in June this year, Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Thanks a lot, Bob.
Thank you. I have this feeling it's one of these topics you can go either way, and so walking from the parking lot here, I could work myself up to be pessimistic or optimistic, probably depending on how much traffic I encounter from coming downtown. And I don't think that anybody really has a handle on what's happening. We're obviously in a situation of flux, but I certainly am in the optimistic camp. I teach media and society, and one of the things I point out to my students is that technology has changed media in many ways, but all the predictions turn out to be wrong. The book, for instance, should be finished, but this week we'll have the Los Angeles Times Book Festival, which my wife, more than anyone else, inspired when she was the vice president there at the Los Angeles Times, and everyone thought it took her 10 years to get going. They said it would never work. No one in L.A. reads. We get that kind of dig all the time. And the fact is we have this enormously successful book festival, and everybody says it, and books are doing better than ever. And L.A. happens to be the biggest book market in the country. If you go look at the list, movies should have disappeared with the coming of television. Movies are obviously very vital. People still go to, they go more than ever to cinemaplexes. They like to congregate around that campfire. Even though they can watch them at home, they still tend to do an old-fashioned thing like go out to the movie theater on the weekends and so forth. Most of the predictions have turned out, as I say, not to be valid. The radio certainly is vital, exciting, and should have also disappeared. So with each new technological change in our predictions, it's all over and we'll have something new. And I do think, in terms of newspapers themselves, I think it's, in a way, a good thing that they not be so prominent, because a lot of trees have to be cut down, and there's an enormous expense in delivering them, and they're not very efficient. And the reason most people read these papers online now is they don't want to wait the 12, 13, 14 hours for the thing to come thumping down on their porch. That's why I stopped reading the LA Times and the New York Times. I read them the night before. And I go home and I read it online, and it's fine. And I have a nice printer if I want to read text and so forth. And so the real issue here is what kind of model will develop. And I think we're in a crunch of developing a new business model. But print has never been stronger than it is now. Most of what is called news, and certainly on the internet, is print. There's a certain amount of video, and audio, but basically it's print, and it's basically what print journalists did. The question is whether these print organizations can find a model that allows them to pay for reporters and so forth to go around. I suspect they will find it and are finding it, and if it's not them, then it will be Google or Yahoo. I can only tell you, for our little site, and I never understand the question of mass media. What is it or not? I mean, I spent my life, I started out with Ramparts, it's true, and I now do something I consider Ramparts on Speed, which is Truthdig. And we've had over 18 million unique visits on a given day. We also can have the hundreds of thousands, and not only do we have the hundreds of thousands, but we can spread to millions by everyone else networking like crazy. We're putting up stories right now today with the Center for Investigative Journalism up there in Oakland, and hopefully we'll reach millions of people through that whole network and so forth. We certainly did it with Kevin Tillman, the brother of Pat Tillman, when he wrote about the death of his brother. Again, I could show you millions of readers come. So I'm not quite sure. I worked for the Los Angeles Times not just as a columnist, but I was a reporter there for 17 years. Almost every interview here except the one with Carter was done for the LA Times. So I was there during the heyday of print journalism. And I never acted differently when I was with the mass media, when I was with writing for The Nation. I never accepted. I just thought you're supposed to do work. And I was thinking about the Seder. Because every time I heard about a Seder, I think, well, did that 12-year-old ask the question, why is the Lord visiting the plagues on these people? Why do they drown their firstborn? That's a good journalist in the making, right? Those people didn't vote for the pharaohs, right? They aren't responsible. Why are they being held accountable? You can always tell. People have a certain set mindset. They'll make interesting journalists, and they'll find a way. They'll find an avenue. Some of them can be professors, like John Wiener is here, and he does a great radio show, and a lot of people listen to it. Who would have ever thought Pacifica Radio would be so vital? And it is. It has its troubles. I'm not going to romanticize it. But it's there. I can tell you, like with our left, right, and center show, we have a tremendous audience now because of podcasting and iTunes. And what you didn't mention, John Stewart and the Colbert Report and all this stuff that goes on.
I'm only given 40 minutes.
So I would say, it's not a criticism, but I just think, you can get bummed out, you get optimistic. First of all, my prejudice is I don't know when the good old days were. Okay? As far as I'm concerned, the American public is as well informed now as they ever been in my lifetime. And the lies about Iraq, which were substantial, caught up just as rapidly, or actually more rapidly than the lies about Vietnam. And I was thinking about during this controversy about the Reverend Wright and everything, because, I remember when Martin Luther King gave his speech at Riverside Church condemning the United States as the major purveyor of violence in the world today. You will probably remember that speech. And in that speech, which was a year before his death, he said, how can I go into the ghetto community and tell people to preach the message of nonviolence when my government does this and so forth? And a very strong speech. He was condemned in the New York Times for that speech. We printed it at Ramparts. I remember the first time I went to Vietnam in 64. Sure, there were some good reporters. Homer Biggert of the New York Times, an ex-police reporter, was good. Halberstam at some points was good. But in the main, the mass media went along with the lies about a war that never made any sense. Never. never had a shred of justification. Went along with basically the whole Cold War posture without making much sense. And I just wonder, what were the good old days? And when I think of these, some of the, you know, what are we going to lose? Well, take the New York Times again. You know, we celebrate something called investigative journalism. New York Times gave us the Wendell Lee case. A total fraud in the name of investigative journalism. This poor guy was held in solitary for 9 months. For what? What crime? He hadn't committed a crime. And the judge, a Reagan-appointed judge, when he released him, said, I owe you an apology, and the government owes you an apology for having been here. Well, he was a victim of investigative journalism. Whitewater. Clinton at one point said the New York Times did to him what they did to Wendell Lee. So we can go down the list of it. I was thinking about the L.A. Times and the Times when I was a journalist. I never found any great interest over there in major stories. I'll just give you some examples. When we had the big staff in Washington, and we used to even fly first class, we had a lot of resources and so forth. Telecommunications Act, hardly reported on by anybody in the mass media. Financial Services Modernization Act, you remember that one? Now that we have the subprime scandal that permitted the banks, the stockbrokers, right, the insurance companies to merge. Go look back at the reporting on that, you know. Welfare reform, talk about poverty. I left the LA Times as a reporter because they wouldn't print my final story on welfare. I wrote a series on welfare. They wouldn't print it. And it was all about Clinton's phony claims of great success in dealing with welfare as governor and his Project Success program. It was a total fraud. I had to publish that in The Nation. So there's always been this sort of yin-yang of, you know, the mass media. You work for the New York Review of Books, started, by the way, by philanthropists. Nation never made any money. Now I think this first year they may be making a little bit, Wiener tells me. Over, 130-year history, longest book. So nothing wrong, by the way, with getting money from different sources. I'm doing that now with Truthdig. I put some of my own money in. We take no money out, my partner and I. It's Wade Kaufman, my partner. We did this. But I will tell you, by the way, we have right now, we have one journalist in Iraq. We have another on the way, and we have a third going. So you can do it, and you can raise the money, and you can cover news. We've already had journalists go to Afghanistan. We cover Africa. It's boring. Eat your veggies. Nobody wants to. We have Nikki Ketty writing about Iran, probably the best informed person in the United States. And one of the things that always hits me at USC when I wander around that campus, people come up to me and say, oh, you do a great job, blah, blah, blah. And I say, oh, thank you. Yeah, and sometimes they even say, you're so brave. Oh, thank you. And then I walk away and I say, wait a minute, what about you? You're the head of our mini department, you know. You're the great expert on China. Or, you know, all this. Why aren't you writing? And you have tenures. Can't be a money question, right? I mean, you make a good living. Why aren't you writing? Why aren't you part of the debate? Why aren't we hearing more from you? Or the scientists or what have you. We have a good piece we're going to be writing next week by W.W. Wilms over in your education department here on education, something that people don't want to write about. And okay, you go to a professor and say, you know a lot about this, you're studying this, we can write about it. So in the main, I say that we're not good old days. I think we'll find ways of supporting journalism. If Google and Yahoo would be a little more generous with the Google ads that we all run now, that would be a serious source of income. There's nothing wrong with getting support from different sources. It can be done. But I would say there's also some very positive things happening now. When I went to work for the LA Times, we had no competition. No one read the New York Times here, or certainly not the Washington Post. New York Times arrived 2-3 days later, okay, and it was no fish wrap. And there was no internet. Washington Post you never saw at all. And in fact, one of my complaints at the LA Times, I said, why do we have this big bureau doing what the Washington Post is doing when we have an alliance with the Washington Post? Why don't we ever run their stories? You know, because no one here would know. We didn't have the Washington Post. Well, now it's fundamentally different. If people are interested, and our job as teachers is to get them interested, or journalists to get them interested, they can find everything, right? They can go read The Independent and get Robert Fisk. They can get The Nation. It's there. And I'll give you a very good example on this controversy with the Reverend Wright. You had those stupid sound clips, okay? And then we posted, and we're not the only ones, but we posted the full sermon And you read that sermon, you realize how screwed up the media was. You realize what a lie it was. You know, the chickens coming home to roost was a beautiful sermon. I don't know, conservatism, my class agreed. And by the way, it wasn't his phrase. He was quoting a white ambassador. And he wasn't invoking scripture. He said, I'm doing a faith footnote now. And he took a break. Well, you can do that. Why? Because it's on YouTube. You can get both of his controversial sermons, and you can realize the controversy wasn't there. This book that, I'll give you another example of the internet, the Five Biggest Lies book about Iraq. My son wrote an article that actually had the 10 biggest lies. The only criticism I've heard about five biggest lies is why only five lies? And I tell people they're broad rubrics and you can have thousands of lies at each one. But my son, who, you know, he's a very good journalist and everything, he figured out a lot of the crap that was being said about Iraq before we went to war, and he wrote the 10 biggest lies for Alternet, one of the websites. And then people found it interesting, and then Alternet put out a message, would anybody like to expand this and bring it out as a book? And people contributed, I forget the amount, $50,000 or something. And lo and behold, there was a book. And some small publishers got it, and the book did quite well. I'll give you just finally one little other example of optimism, pessimism. This book, Playing President, which I rather like, collection, was published by a former rock, alternative rock guy, Johnny Temple. He's a guy in his 30s, and he made some extra money, and he decided to book publishing, Akashic Books, very good book publishing. Small press, but they get out there. Hachette, which is my current book, it's the same one that did Hitchens. They only do one book a month, and now I have big machinery behind me. I think they're both good books. I don't know whether one will really do much better than the other, but it comes to an excuse for inactivity to say you can't learn, you can't get it out there, and so forth. There are lots of avenues. And now, if you have a good story, there are lots of places to publish it. If you want to be informed, you can get a lot of information. You don't have to go down to the 42nd Street Library and do what Izzy Stone or in Washington. You know, you can go on YouTube and get Wright's sermon. And you can get, you know, some of you are historians, you can get documents that are 200 years old, and they're on the internet. So we have this incredible tool of the internet. It's got its failings, but it's a tool that we've never had before. And, you know, a quote I had in the Five Biggest Lies, which is attributed to Twain, you know, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth puts its pants on. Well, now, you know, truth catches up a little faster. And that's really what the internet is very good. But let me provide a structural point for our discussion here, because I actually had a totally different speech. I misunderstood the topic. And I thought I'd come to do battle with John Yoo and all that. But
2 weeks.
Okay. All right. I want to make a structural point, and then I want to make a summary so I can just look at my own little spiel here. Because the question I thought was, what has changed under George Bush? I guess that's the rubric of the whole larger meeting. So I wrote down three things that are very positive. And if our media is in such trouble and we are so screwed up, why have these positive things happened? So these are my positive things. One is the end of empire with a question mark. So we have at least had major discrediting of an old failed system of imperialism. And instead of it taking as long as Vietnam does, yes, there's a lot of human suffering and so forth, most Americans now understand the old imperial model doesn't work. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen again. Get another crisis, another fear, and I'll get to that. But the fact is, most Americans know the neoconservatives were full of it, that there is no empire on the cheap, the oil will not pay for it, people will not welcome us with flowers, and that intervention sucks. Okay? And that, you know, having this oil, gasoline is over $4 a gallon down the street. Okay, so there's been a discrediting of that model, which they were pushing. That's what the Project for New America was all about. My book deals with that. That in real time, that model has been discredited. Secondly, I don't think most Americans now think of us as the city on the hill, which was another Reagan revival, that we are the repository of all virtue, we know everything, and so forth. I think there's a general sense we ought not to meddle because maybe we don't have it all figured out. Maybe these people have different languages and different religions, and maybe it's complex. Maybe we should tread lightly, and so forth. The return to moral indifference, but maybe not sticking your nose in where you don't know what you're doing. and that it's a messy world out there, and that certain caution is required. And finally, on a domestic issue, which I think has tremendous international ramification, is that the market is not the center of all morality and all rational decision-making. That, in fact, we need regulation, that we have to have an input of the social needs, of the common good, and so forth, and that people get hurt, whether it's in global warming, or subprime mortgage, or what have you, or trade, that and loss of jobs, and so forth. There's a recognition that there's an important role for government to play, and that we should be conscious of it and try to figure out what the useful parameters are. So there has been a tremendous defeat in this period for the three main tenets of what was the revival of the conservative movement. And I argue that that would not have happened were facts not able to catch up with lies. And in fact, public has been able to be informed. Okay. Now, let me get on the more pessimistic side. I think this goes back to a basic truth that our founders, and I know whatever I say on this, I'll probably have it wrong, and I'll be told so by historians like Wiener. But it seems to me this whole notion of American democracy was based on a recognition that once you have empire, you can't have democracy, to put it crudely. That if you are dealing democratically, representative government, in terms of a world that you can comprehend, you can make basically sound decisions. Not always, but basically you have a chance for the thing to work. And that means you'll have the information, okay? That's why you want to keep it local, all right? You should absolutely have included larger people, a number of people like women and blacks and so forth. But the fact is, the model was a sound one. If decision-making is kept local and people can understand that world and get it, they'll make the right decision. The problem is when you move out, not just to the nation state, but then this national security state, you lose that. And that is corresponded to my own experience as a journalist. I wrote local columns here in Los Angeles for the LA Times. I've covered local news and so forth. There's no problem getting through to the public on local. If you say, should you have a traffic light on Wilshire and 20th, there people know. They'll tell you how many accidents have happened, what the negative part is, and so forth. They'll tell you whether a pedestrian sidewalk should extend or not extend, you know. And if you make an error, they'll catch you on it. If you say it's San Juan Street, San Juan Avenue, I still don't know the difference, you'll get 400, 500 letters. So as long as it's local, people know. When you move to the national, it's a little more difficult. What was the financial service? What does it tell you? It's a little confusing. Who's getting screwed? Who's doing the screwing? When you get to international, it's hopeless. Hopeless. Because the basic information is withheld from you by the whole argument of national security. And you cannot have a functioning, serious representative government if you want to have an empire. That, to mine, is the deal breaker. People who want to have representative democracy and a rational allocation of their resources have to resist the impulse to empire. Even when it's done by neoliberals, and not just neoconservatives, for do-gooder reasons, though so they claim, like going into Afghanistan, as Jimmy Carter did, right, to stop the Soviets. But in the main, if what you think you are going to do is set about settling the affairs of the world, and with the military, I'm not talking about trade and aid and or stuff like that, but if you're going to find some kind of model of empire, you cannot have a functioning democracy. And there's, to put it, give you a crude measure of it, why did the Soviet Union, which had a total authoritarian regime, totally repressive, make no more errors than we did in foreign policy during the Cold War? They backed as many decent regimes as we did. They backed as many evil regimes as we did. They made as many stupid mistakes as we did, right? But there's absolutely no correlation, and if you evaluate the whole post-war period, between doing the right thing and having the trappings or the appearance of democracy. I mean, if you look at a movie, Fog of War. How many of you have seen that movie? One of the best documentaries ever made on McNamara, won the Academy Award. I show it in my class all the time. I wanted to quote you, what you said about you. You said he was sharp, very sharp, John Yoo.
I repeated myself.
Okay, I'm repeating you. Sorry. I'm sure he's sharp. The most annoying thing is, why is there no correlation between intelligence and doing the right thing? okay? I mean, this is the real mystery. And so if you look at the movie Fargo West, well, there was McNamara, this brilliant graduate of Berkeley, right, who was picked in the Pentagon because he was one of the smartest individuals in the whole country. They did a test, the whole United States. And what does he do in the Pentagon? He figures out the most effective way to destroy Japanese cities that are made of wood. Right, killing 40, 50, 60, 70% of the people. One of the great terrorists in human history, right? McNamara, right? This is before we dropped the bomb, another genius project of the University of California, I should point out. So there's absolutely, when it comes to these foreign policy things, you cannot find a correlation between having this society that we all love of limited government, separation of powers, free press, and ending up doing the right thing. You have a free press and all the guarantees that we care about, and you have Judy Miller lying about weapons of mass destruction in the New York Times, being really one of the main agencies in distorting the situation and getting us into this war. This very paper that was passing was supposed to be morning here, right? And yet it wasn't the Fox News that got us into the Iraq War. It was the New York Times and other respectable news organizations. And they bought into all of the lies about it. You know? So if you think about it, the real problem here is not this ordering of our news gathering or that. I personally think it will find an equilibrium. People want news. Locally, they want to know where are the good restaurants and, you know, what's the good housing situation. And they want to know, are there crooks running our government? And if you don't get it from the New York Times, you'll have what Arianna Huffington's doing now, local websites. And other people are getting into local news. You can go to LA Observe, which is a very strong site here in LA. But there are many like that. There are neighborhood bloggings and neighborhood things and so forth. People will get the news. That news is not costly to get, okay? And you don't have national security. Where we run into problems here, I would argue, are in two areas. Domestically, when you have powerful interests that can totally shape the agenda. That's the financial service modernization and telecommunications and so forth. You're absolutely right. But that was true in the good old days. The good old days, the LA Times had Bernstein as the labor writer. Then it had Henry Weinstein, and then it had Nancy Cleveland. All good people. But you're right. The newspaper never felt the need to have more than one. And those people were very, very much contained, or at least the paper tried to contain. Why? Because they're a powerful interest. They didn't really want that story covered. You know, the Los Angeles Times was an anti-union paper from day one, and they didn't particularly want to cover labor. They thought it was a problem that they'd like to have go away. So in the main, you will always have that bias on so-called domestic issues in terms of the rich and powerful who can pay for these things. There's nothing new. But where it really shows up, as I said before, is in this foreign policy area. It's hopeless. And it's hopeless because even if you send all of these reporters there, you're going to be late and it's going to be distorted. And I agree with you, embedding is terrible, but they always were embedded. You know, the first time I ever went to Vietnam, I mean, I went there and I had to bribe a truck driver to take me out to the countryside because no one was going there. And the son of a bitch left me in the countryside. And I suddenly found myself in the middle of a Graham Greene novel. What am I doing here? It's always been that way. Group journalism basically shaped, you know, you all saw the New York Times story, I guess it was yesterday or Sunday, on how effective the Defense Department has been in planting their experts on all these shows. But there's nothing new about that. And as I say, let me take on my 40 minutes.
Go ahead.
Okay. The only point of disagreement is maybe it's because I was there trying to do the job when things were when it was supposed to be the good old days. Okay. So what I wonder is why did it take Ramparts and Cy Hirsch, who wrote for us among other places, and The Nation. And the New York Review of Books, by the way, which started quite early. Why did it take us to figure out that the U.S. intervention in Vietnam never made any sense? Why did it go on for a decade?
Well, David Halberstam had a big role.
Yes, David Halberstam had a big role in saying the U.S. military...
And Neil Shea.
Yes, and David Halberstam and that reporting, which came quite late, by the way, had a lot to do. I remember writing my. I love David, and I considered him a great friend. But I remember I wrote a review in Ramparts of his first book, The Making of a Quagmire, and I said, you know, he is the quiet American in this book, because it was always about a better way to win. It's like the argument now about Iraq. It never accepts. Maybe we aren't the necessary agents of change. Maybe we don't know who these people are or how to bring about change. Maybe we do not have their interests at heart. maybe the royal we of America does not make any sense. You know, Halliburton ripped off all these funds, and where is the CEO headquartered now? But in the Emirates. Maybe we don't have a national interest. Maybe there are class divisions, so forth. I mean, so, I think that era characterized a lot of the reporting. It doesn't mean there wasn't good reporting about the lies of the effect of the bombing or, you know, Mili, which was basically Cy Hirsch when he was outside Dispatch News when he was a counter journalist. But that's not my point that journalists don't do good work. They do. And they can be quite courageous. But I'll conclude on this and say the problem has to be different than resources, because certainly with Vietnam we had great resources, and the situation only changed when the military situation collapsed. It wasn't that the public became enlightened. We have actually had more opposition to the Iraq War than we did during the Vietnam War. It wasn't that the facts got in the way of a good story. They always were in the way. I mean, just take the most basic thing about Vietnam, that we went in there to replace, I don't want to visit the whole story, we went in to replace French colonialism. You know, that was the basic thing.
Later, okay, yeah, let's have a break.
Everybody will.
Yeah.
One of the things to do is you guys get to.
I don't mind having a discussion. I don't want to be driving home tonight saying I had a false argument. Okay, so let me say the false argument that I want to avoid. Yes, individual journalists have done great, heroic journalism, okay? And I'm not putting any of them down. I'm married to a woman that never did anything but work in mainstream journalism, Narda Zucchino. She was a great journalist, and when she was the Associated LA Times, she was a great journalist. She ran half the newspaper, and most recently she was the deputy editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and she just did a book with Mary Tillman on the Tillman case, which is coming out next week, and hopefully it'll be a very successful mainstream book. And Henry Weinstein, and Bill Boyarsky, who writes for our site. Now, we have many of these people. Chris Hedges has this column on Truthdig right now. He's one of our journalists. We pay him. Not the New York Times did, but, you know, Chris Hedges is able to do good work for us because when he was the New York Times bureau chief, he did great work there. My point was, yes, people do good work because they ask the right question at the Seder. And if they happen to end up at the Baltimore Sun and they ask the right question at the Seder and they have that mindset, you know, because their parents raised them right or some teacher got to them and they'll be tough to ask about it, they'll do good journalism. And if they can't do it there, they'll go right for the New York Review of Books. So they'll do, you know, it's in our body, our genes or something, to do good journalism when we do it. So I'm not saying anyone's got a monopoly on it or it only happens in certain places. That's number one. Number two, I don't want to have a false argument about the need for resources. I'm in the business of raising money to do journalism. Yes, there are airplane tickets to be purchased, hotel rooms to be gotten, there's equipment that's needed, and so forth. I'm not denying that. And as I said, the industry is now in a position where it has to work out these new models. I think it will work. They will work out the models. But my main concern is that there's a celebration of our way of life, our separation of powers, right? Our Constitution, our limits, all the things that we are raised to celebrate. And I ask the question then, if all those things are so important, and I always have thought they were so important, then why isn't the end product better? You know, for instance, take it closer to home. If tenure is such a great system, right, that it protects academic freedom, why do we get so little out of the university that's interesting? I mean, come on. I mean, you know, give me a break. I mean, how many, maybe we do on the medical side. I don't know. But, I mean, how many, you know, I remember when I was doing Ramparts, and then I ran for Congress in the Berkeley-Oakland area, and we got the seat we got for Ron Dellums and everything. I couldn't get any support on the social science faculty, with the exception of Franz Sherman. It was the biological scientists who supported me. But if you went, in fact, one of them, right now, he's a great writer, and we all love him, Charles Johnson, but in those days he was on the other side. So, you know, or Scalapino or all those people. So I really have to, you know, you have to, okay, we celebrate academic freedom. We celebrate the tenure system. We celebrate our independence. And then here we have these big universities all the place. And why, with the exception of some a few people like Nikki Keddie who actually take their area, discipline, and bother to educate the rest of it, why does so little come out that's interesting? Why are so many of the PhDs that are written so besides the point? You know, why do we put people through a training program in which they make these issues boring or marginalized? So, so you take that same kind of focus and say, okay, same thing for the newspapers. Why did so little come out of that was interesting of the newspapers in the best of times? Okay? And I finally, just to summarize, I think the problem is, and it's overly simplistic, there's two problems. Okay. One, I stressed, the foreign policy one, that if you make the decision to have empire, you forget about public control. The other one, which I haven't stressed, but I could go on at great length because I tried to cover those stories, we do have a class system. We do have rich, powerful people who are getting it ever more so. And we do have a relation between our own country and its power and the rest of the world. And that if they can force the prism, if they can set the rules, which they have done all my life, you know, my slogan, I forget who I got from Niebling or something, you know, comfort the afflicted, afflict the comfortable. You know, but the comfortable are the ones who own your publication most of the time. If they can set that agenda, you're not going to read very much that's interesting about poverty and welfare reform or homelessness or the bank scandal or what have you. You're just not, because it's not in their interest to do that. And it's only when people rebel against it and develop alternative models like The Nation or Cape and Fear or something that you get that. So I, in that sense, yes, we never had good old days. We don't have them now. There's a need for a lot of vigilance in that area.
Thanks so much, Bob. Okay, it's about 3:41 and a half or something. And why don't we come back here by, we're going to start a little before 5:02.
It wasn't needed.
So we have a little bit less than 15 minutes. There's coffee across the hall. Please come back here soon, and we will have a discussion with the audience and the people on the panel.
Thanks for all the mental. Is there any way I can bring it to you? There's some things I might want to write, and then I might have, I have a suggestion for somebody who might pick up on Iran, and that's Barbara Slavin, who's done a very good book. And she gets into Iran still. And so she doesn't want to criticize the government much, but she interviewed one of the last people who was in there. But the kind of thing I'd want to write would be more kind of think pieces, like I'm thinking of, because I'm not in Iran, I don't know
no,
that
no,
kind
no.
of teaching or stuff. But like I'm very Sudrak, I sort of coined the phrase two cultures for Iran. Traditional religious, etc., is a class into, and then the you know, the Western modernist. And we see the same thing in the United States, and I don't think this has been pointed out. And the question is how to overcome, you know, to deal with it, that kind of thing. Now I don't know if you're interested in that kind of thing. So I want to know to who to write.
Bob Shearer at Gmail.
Okay. And I've had a horrible, and it's still going on week to week, not only with my pain, but with mold in a condo, which is worse than in a regular building. So I haven't had time to, but I do want to do something of that kind. And,
okay.
Barbara Slavin, I'll send you her address.
Great.
Okay.
Okay.
I want to tell you, I admire you, but unlike some others, I have done a little of my remarks against the war here in New York City. I can't forgive Hillary from both, of course, so really, Obama for that reason, among others.
No, Obama
I think,
was opposed.
What?
Obama
has been opposed,
yeah.
And I'm for him.
Yeah, so am I.
But you've done this right for us. You came out here with your comments. One of the few voices that say this. Great.
Rob Stewart one.
Yeah.
How you doing? I'm going to have to go with
to leave us alone,
yeah.
And let us reward you.